Welcome, guys, to episode 67 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this week I bring to you an incredible man who I think is an inspiration and really sets the bar as to the challenges of life. Rob Jones was an engineer with the Marine Corps out in Afghanistan and was caught in an IED explosion, lost both his legs. And instead of letting that injury define him and make him crumble, he decided to use it as an inspiration. Rob has been an Olympian with the rowing team. He has done 31 marathons in 31 days and is just basically hatching more ways to show everyone that their injuries don't define them, and that, you know, life is not over when we get challenges. So this was an incredible episode yet again. So many great minds on this podcast, but Rob was truly inspiring. I loved talking to him, and the positivity and inspiration from this man was mind-blowing. So before we get to the interview, as always, if you could go to iTunes, I implore you to give us a review, give us a rating. I hear 5 out of 5 is the way to go in the podcast world. It makes us more visible. And then again, just pick an episode. Think of a friend who would be inspired by that particular guest and share it. If we all shared with 3 people, they shared with 3 people, before you know it, every first responder is going to hear this podcast. So without further ado, I introduce to you an incredible man, Rob Jones. Enjoy. All right, well, welcome, Rob, to the Behind the Shield podcast. Where are we finding you today?
I live in Vienna, Virginia. It's right outside D.C.
Okay, and was that where you were born?
No, I was born in Columbia, Maryland, which is close to here. And then I grew up in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is just a little bit further west of where I am. So I'm in my home area.
Okay, fantastic. So what was your family life like when you were young?
Pretty normal. My parents were split up, but they both remarried. I grew up with, living primarily with my mom and my stepfather, and they had a horse farm. And so I grew up, you know, doing chores around the horse farm. I hated horses because I had to pick up out of their poop, almost every day. So I did not have a good relationship with them. Spent my summers weed whacking, mowing the lawn, and stacking hay bales and doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, besides that, just hanging out with my friends and pretty normal childhood.
Sounds like we had a very similar upbringing. My dad was a horse veterinarian.
So, oh, there you go.
Yeah, I was mucking out stables my whole childhood.
We had like 12 of them. It was brutal.
Yeah, it is. People don't understand hard work until you grow up on a farm. So did you have any military in your family back then?
You know, my dad was drafted in Vietnam. He didn't go to Vietnam, and he just, you know, did his, I think maybe like it was 2 years or something that he had to do, and then he got out and didn't really talk about it much or anything. So I didn't really have a whole lot of, you know, military influence in my family or anything.
Right. So what did you want to do as a career when you were in school? What was your aspiration then?
When I was in high school, I wanted to be a computer game programmer because I liked playing video games and I enjoyed doing computer science. And that's what I went to college for originally. But I didn't. I realized somewhere in my junior year, I either wasn't good enough at it or I wasn't studious enough at the time to make it a viable employment possibility.
Right. Now, you talked about college, and please correct me if I'm wrong. You went to Virginia Tech, is that correct?
Yeah, I went to Virginia Tech between 2003 and 2007.
Okay. Had you just graduated when that awful shooting happened?
That was in my last semester, actually.
Oh, so you were actually still there when that happened?
Yeah. So that happened, and then I graduated the next month.
Wow. Okay, because I saw that. I kind of Googled the dates and realized they aligned almost perfectly.
You know, it didn't affect, you know, I wasn't, you know, in the vicinity. I was in my apartment off campus or anything, so I wasn't anywhere near it.
Yeah, it was awful. One of the kind of through lines I talked to some guests about, like I had Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman on here and Tim Kennedy and some of these other guys, is these awful mass shootings and how, you know, how we prepare for them now and how you try and be that kind of sheepdog role just in case something like that happens again.
Yeah, you know, I remember at the time, I had actually been to boot camp the previous summer. So I had been drilling at my reserve unit, and I remember at the time just feeling like shit because I wasn't there, and maybe I thought maybe I could have done something, but you know, so I kind of felt like shit about that. But you know, you're either there or you're not. You know, it's a matter of circumstance.
Yeah, well, I think that I heard someone talk about this a little while ago. This is two types of people: the people that wish they were there, and the people that are thankful they weren't there. And I think that, you know, Marines, firefighters, police, they're the ones that wish they were there, and I can definitely relate to that. So scaling back to your childhood just for a moment, were you an athlete back then?
You know, I was big into sports, playing baseball and soccer growing up, and up until I got to high school. And then I fell behind the other guys in terms of growing, because I was a little tiny kid. I was about 88 pounds. In ninth grade, and so, you know, my body just didn't develop as fast, and so I kind of moved away. I couldn't make any of the teams I wanted to make, and so I moved away from sports, and I got into the computer stuff, and I didn't really get back into you know, training, sports, and that kind of stuff until I joined the Marine Corps, because I needed to be in shape for boot camp and all that.
Right. So when did you have that pivotal moment where you decided that the military was going to be where you'd pursue?
It was in my junior year at Virginia Tech. Like I said, I had just realized that computer science probably wasn't going to be in the cards. Or I wasn't – I guess what's more accurate was I wasn't willing to put in the effort that was going to be required. And I know that now as a mature adult, but at the time I probably figured I just wasn't good enough. And so I was kind of a lonely kid. I was a loner and was looking for something, just something. You know, I needed something besides what I was doing. And I felt like maybe I needed to do something that was more than just myself. Because I, you know, going to college and lived all through high school, you know, I was kind of just worried about myself, and maybe I figured I would flip the script on that. And so a buddy of mine had just joined the Marine Corps the year before, and so I started researching it, and I read the book Brotherhood of Heroes about the Battle of Pele Lu, and it was reading that book that, you know, that clicked for me. You know, I knew what I had to do after that.
Okay, so you said you had to get in shape for a boot camp. What did you do to prepare for that?
So, you know, I just did the PFT, basically. The Marine Corps Physical Fitness Test is a 3-mile run, pull-ups, as many pull-ups as you can, and then as many sit-ups as you can in 2 minutes. So I just made sure I just started running. I started doing pull-ups, and I started doing sit-ups and push-ups and that kind of stuff, because I knew, just from what the recruiters told me and from what little amount of research I could do, that you needed to be good at that kind of stuff. So besides that, just started working on my Marine Corps knowledge that they were going to teach me in boot camp. You know, recruiters help you out with that a lot. And, you know, that's about it. Just started training, you know, pretty, you know, the day after I enlisted.
Okay. And did you request to join the engineers, or was that something you were assigned?
That was a matter of circumstance, because I joined the reserves, and the closest reserve unit, or the reserve unit that I was going to be joining, because I lived in Blacksburg, Virginia, was Bravo Company, 4th Combat Engineer Battalion out of Roanoke, Virginia. That was the closest one to me. So they just said, all right, well, this is going to be your reserve unit. And the only billets they have there are combat engineer billets. So, you know, the decision was kind of made for me. But I'm, you know, looking back on it, I'm glad of that. I love the job, and I'm glad that I got it.
Right, yeah. It sounds like if you had the aspirations for the engineering side with the computing, that actually would probably be a good fit for you mentally as well.
It's kind of a total. I didn't end up doing anything that was really what you would consider mechanical engineering or computer engineering or anything like that. I was just dealing, you know, with explosives but it requires a little bit more cerebral person, I suppose.
Right. So, what was the first tour that you saw?
So my first one was 2008, Habaniya, Iraq. My unit was sending a volunteer platoon, and so I volunteered, and yeah, so 2008.
Okay. So you went back to Afghanistan in 2010, is that correct?
Yeah. So in 2008, not much was going on in Iraq, and I had gone over there hoping to, do some fighting, kill some bad guys. And we didn't really get to do much of that. And so it was kind of, I was proud of it. You know, I think we did a lot of good over there. We found a lot of buried weapons caches. So I have no doubt we made the city a lot safer just because of that. And so I was happy about that. But, you know, I did want to do some fighting. And my reserve unit was sending another volunteer platoon to Afghanistan in 2010. And so I volunteered for that right away.
Okay, now what were the differences you saw when you first got there between your initial deployment in Iraq, apart from obviously the combat, and Afghanistan?
So Iraq has a lot more urban places. So it has its big cities, and then it has its smaller towns and the outskirts of the big cities, and they're all built up, and they have, asphalt roads and buildings and, basically like any town here, except with different materials and, a little bit less infrastructure. But you get to Afghanistan and there's, they have their big cities, and then there's one road that goes around the whole city called the Ring Road. And then everything else is just dirt and mud compounds, just kind of spotted in the distance, and you just spotted away from each other, and mountains, and it's a lot more kind of Wild West than Iraq was in terms of the geography.
Right. Okay. So can you describe, because obviously a lot of my audience are going to be firefighter, police, EMS, some of whom are veterans and obviously will know exactly what you're talking about. But for the rest of us, just describe the role of the Marine Combat Engineer.
Yeah. It is to say the combat engineer actually describes three different possibilities. First possibility is you can work with an air wing, and so you'll be doing a lot of stuff with airports, runways, and that kind of stuff. So you'll be doing whatever they need you to do, bulk fuel and all sorts of stuff like that. The other possibility would be the construction side of it, building up forward operating bases. So if I'm sure you've read Extreme Ownership, so Jocko talks about the engineers that he worked with and how they would have to be building bunkers and stuff like that while under fire. And so that's the other aspect, doing stuff like that, filling the sandbags and building stuff. And the third aspect is what I was doing, which is called the division side engineer. And what we would do would be we would attach to an infantry battalion. So it would be one platoon for an infantry battalion. And then we'd be broken down. One squad would go with each company in a battalion. And then each fire team in that squad would go with a platoon in that company. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we would just basically just go and be another infantry guy for the infantry platoon squads. When they would go on a patrol, we would go with them. When they would do a push, we would go on their push. And we would be responsible for demolitions. And so whatever – and we'd use them to either create obstacles or defeat obstacles. And so, for example, if there was a door that we needed to breach, We would blow the door off the hinges, or we'd use a Halligan tool or whatever. If there were trees that needed to be destroyed or knocked down so that we can have clear fields of fire for a forward operating base, we'd blow up the trees. So things like that. And then the other aspect would be the finding of buried munitions or improvised explosive devices. And that would be part of, that would be defeating obstacles. So the IED would be classified as an obstacle.
Okay. Now I'm assuming then that your role must have been extremely important, looking from the outside in a war that seems to be fought primarily with terrorist tactics like IEDs. So, I mean, were you constantly having to search for those?
Not constantly. I wouldn't even say it was a daily event, really. The finding wasn't daily. So usually in most patrols, there would be a time where I or another combat engineer would have to check something out. So if we were going to go into on a patrol, there's lots of wadis and bridges that you have to cross over. So every time we would come to a point like that where we would have to be, we'd be forced by terrain to concentrate and use a route or a certain road through an area, I would check that out. So a bridge, you know, we'd have to go over the bridge because we can't just swim across a river. And so the Taliban might plant their IEDs close to that bridge or on either side of that bridge. So I would go check that out.
Right.
And so, whether or not there was anything there, you know, it varied, but I would be going out there and checking.
Okay. So then let me rephrase that. What kind of equipment did you have, and how effective was that in finding these devices?
The equipment would have been a metal detector, a very sophisticated metal detector. Almost more importantly than that was just your own kind of instinct. So you could get to a point where you could look at a route that you're trying to take, and you'd be able to see indicators, you know, dirt that didn't look right, or stacks of rocks that might be marking something, or sunken dirt or discolored dirt, you know, things like that. So the most important thing would be your instincts. And then you would go through there and you would use your metal detector to try and find the little tiny bits of metal that they would put in the IEDs. And so really, it's about as effective a tool as you can get, but it wasn't necessarily 100%, because the dirt could have minerals in it that would set off the metal detector, or you might not have your sensitivity high enough because of that. So you might turn your sensitivity lower because you're just getting all sorts of false readings. And so you turn it lower, and then, you know, lo and behold, there's an IED and you blow up. And so it's about as effective as you can get, but it's not like, you know, you walk out there and it just points at an IED or something.
Yeah, exactly. Some sort of kind of ground radar or something. Okay. Yeah. Well, then you touched on that. So obviously the pivotal point in your story was that day when you did find an IED and it did explode. So are you able to kind of tell us the story of that day and how it unfolded?
Yeah. So we were doing a push. Well, basically what we would do was we had just taken over from the British at FOB Inkerman in Sangin, Afghanistan. And so when I say push, basically what that means is we just go into Taliban territory and start taking stuff over. And if the Taliban wants to try and resist us, we either kill them or they run away. And so what we were doing was, there'd be belts of IEDs, or we'd have intelligence that were belts of IEDs. And so we would launch these line charges, big ass line charges that were about 1,700 pounds of C4. And they would be in a line, and we'd blow those up. And then everybody would just kind of walk through these IED belts on that line of explosives, because that's the only place that we could guarantee that there was nothing, because we had blown up anything that might be there. And then we would, you know, they would send this assault breacher vehicle through with a mine rake and then just rake up the ground in front of us. So we just walk through there. And then once we got through the IED belts, we would start taking over compounds and setting them up in order for us to launch further operations from those forward operating bases. And so we'd do that for a day, and then we'd set up we would clear, make sure there was nothing in there were booby traps or anything in these compounds that we were going into. So that's what me and other combat engineers would do. Once we cleared it, then we would set up and just start doing foot patrols and secure the area. And then once we felt confident about we were ready to go again, we would do that same process again. And so on the second time, we had the vehicle column that was clearing the IED belts, and I was part of an infantry squad that was kind of skirting along the outside and protecting that vehicle column from ambushes. And at some point during the day, we sat down to take a break, and we stood back up, and the point man stepped on an IED. And so and luckily there was no injury to him because the IED malfunctioned, and so all that happened was the blasting cap exploded and it didn't set off the main charge, which is what it's supposed to do. So the IED, obviously you have this little small blasting cap that gets set off by the heat in a wire or an electric charge in a wire, and then that blows up the main charge, which is usually a big jug of homemade explosives. And so his didn't work. And so now that becomes an area where I need to come forward and guide us through, because the likelihood that there's going to be another IED somewhere in there is about 100%. Because the Taliban, as everybody probably knows, they like to put, you know, the primary and the secondary, tertiary IEDs, so that anybody that came to rescue that first guy would get hit as well. And so it'd just be like a chain reaction. And so I went out to guide us through that area, and I missed the IED that got me, and it hit me, and that resulted in double above knee amputations.
Wow. So what happened right there and then? Where were you taken to, and what was the initial treatment for such a horrendous injury?
The initial treatment was tourniquets. So, you know, I was unconscious for about 20 seconds. And so I wake up. And, you know, screaming, other Marines. So in this particular case, they couldn't just run over to me because, like I said, there's primary, secondary, tertiary possibility of IEDs being in the area. And so they actually had to get another guy to clear over to me, you know, while I'm sitting there bleeding out. And I'm sure he kind of did it in a quick fashion, but they couldn't just run over to me. And so, you know, they're like, they're telling me, you know, we're coming. And then they get there and they put the tourniquets on, they give me the morphine, and then they take me to a nearby tank. And then the tank meets a helicopter. Helicopter takes me out of there. And then 5 days later, I'm in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. So was Maryland the first stop from your, as far as your medical attention? And that's where you did the initial wound care?
No. So they would have taken me from site of injury and sang into, I think, Camp Leatherneck, and there's a hospital there. And so they would have done, you know, debridements and any kind of alterations that they needed to do, revisions, they call them. And then so they would do that, stabilize me, and then they moved me to, I think, Bagram Air Force Base, which is also in Afghanistan, and do the same thing. And then put me on a aircraft to Germany, Landstuhl, Germany. There's another hospital, and they would do the same thing. And then they flew me from Germany to Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Wow. And that's a hell of a trip just to get to that point. So yeah. Obviously you had the physical injuries. At what point did they start giving you the psychological help of what you've been through as well?
I spent the first 5 days unconscious, and then the next 7 days I spent high on morphine and painkillers, going in for surgeries, and, you know, just my body, that's just for my body getting used to all the, you know, all the chemicals that was getting put into it. You know, you just kind of need that time to process everything and get used to it. So that next week was pretty much a loss. And then get moved up to the fifth floor. Probably took another 5 or so days for me to really get my senses totally cleared. And then that's when they start bringing in all the different doctors, the orthopedic surgeons, the pain specialists, the, you know, whatever doctor can possibly want to talk to you. That's when they start bringing them in. And then they also bring in the psychological doctors, and they basically give you, they ask you a bunch of questions. They test, test how your mind is. And, you know, it was determined I didn't have any kind of lasting post-traumatic stress effects, you know, luckily for me. So I didn't really require much in terms of, you know, therapy or counseling or anything like that.
All right. So
somehow.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing in itself. But so what was your self-talk, you know, that once the morphine had worn off and everything had kind of sunk in, and you're lying in this bed with this double amputation, were you initially thinking, I'm going to beat this and I'm going to go and be better than I was before? Or, you know, was there a period where you just, you know, weren't sure what you were going to do?
I think, you know, looking back on it, so in with the power of hindsight, I can say that I realized that my life's mission was unchanged. I still wanted to have a good life, a meaningful life, and a life I could be proud of. And I realized that the more energy I spent wishing something hadn't happened, the less energy I would have to spend on what I could affect, and which is, you know, my therapy and recovery and that kind of thing. So, you know, in hindsight, I can say that. But I think at the time, I just kind of was on instinct, kind of like a dog that, you know, you see running around with three legs. He doesn't even really realize he only has – that he should have four legs. And he's just – he just does his thing, you know. So I think I was kind of running on that survival instinct and that kind of a thing. So I wasn't really sitting there doing really deep pondering as much as I was just acting.
Right. Now,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's going to take a long time to sink in. So when did that start to you have that metamorphosis where you start realizing that you're going to have prosthesis and you're going to have to learn, you know, how to walk on those again? What was that journey from the injury through to standing, let's say, for example, like?
Yeah, so my initial thought at site of injury was I assumed I was going to be in wheelchair forever. I assumed I was going to have to, you know, have somebody taking care of me for the rest of my life. I didn't even know. I had no idea. That's just what I assumed. Obviously that was a very, naive outlook, uneducated. But that's what I thought. And then I get to the hospital and then the nurses and the physical therapists come in and they say, well, this is what it's going to be like probably because I'm not the first double above knee amputee that's come through there. So they know. So they can tell me stories about people that have come through and, oh, this is what he's doing now and this is how it went for him. And then also the guys that had actually, you know, kind of graduated from my situation to prosthetics would come back to Bethesda Hospital and do visits and say, you know, this is what my experience was. So I got a lot of intelligence from them about what to expect. And so that made it a whole lot easier to accept the situation, just knowing kind of what to expect. And so it even kind of, you know, made me a little bit excited to, you know, heal up and get going with it because, you know, I was ready to get on with it and just, you know, do what I needed to do to get out of the hospital.
Right. So with a above knee amputation, obviously, I mean, this is common sense, but so you don't have that knee joint to work with at all. So I'm assuming that that's even more challenging to have double prosthesis, even standing and walking without that stabilizing joint.
Yeah, so, you know, less the more limbs you can have, the better. Longer limb you can have, the better. So there's a major difference between a below the knee and above the knee, major difference between single and double. And then there's a major difference between like a long above knee amputation and a really short above knee amputation. So, you know, all those degrees. And then there's even, you know, the double hip disarticulation where you can't even wear, there's nothing. So, so there's a, you know, big steps in between each of those where, you know, you're losing vital parts that would make your life a lot easier.
Right. So what was the first kind of milestone that you gave yourself to achieve with this new prosthesis?
You know, the first milestone I had was actually just to get out of my hospital bed into my wheelchair by myself. And that was, you know, in the first week or so that I could then, you know, go wheel around the hospital. And but with the prosthetic, you know, they fit you with it. And then they get it comfortable. And then the first milestone is taking that first step. You know, you wheel your wheelchair into the parallel bars. And then, you know, your therapist says, all right, go ahead and stand up. And then you use your arms to stand yourself up. And there you are. All right, now you're standing up. That's the first time you've been able to stand up in however long. So, and then, you know, they go, all right, well, take the first step. And you kind of naturally figure out how to do it. It's a very, very ginger, short, you know, maybe 1-inch step, but you know, that's your first step. And then you just kind of keep building on that and building on that. And then, you know, just like any other thing where you practice and practice and practice and you get more comfortable and your body kind of adapts to the different pressures and the different pains that are being put onto it and adapts to that. And then you get more mobile and they heighten your prosthetic. So you start out as a double above knee amputee on basically prosthetic foot on the end of your stump. So you're really short. And then you graduate to a little bit taller as you get your balance, you get better and better, and you can walk for longer distances. And then you figure out how to go off curbs. You just kind of figure out how to use these things in the way that you need to. And then after you get to a certain level with the regular short, no knee joint legs, they give you these legs that are bionic and they have all sorts of sensors in them and they have a knee joint. So now you have to relearn how to use that. So, and then you advance to that. And then kind of once you master that, then you can kind of move on to relearning the more advanced things like running, riding bikes, and, you know, kind of getting back to figuring out what I would call hobbies.
Okay. Now I had a guest, Dr. BJ Miller. I don't know if you've heard of him before. He's a hospice doctor out in San Francisco, but he's a triple amputee, both legs and one arm. He was kind of laughing because he said he used to be tall and almost, it felt like he was too tall, kind of lanky. And after he had the accident, he chose shorter prostheses, partly because, as you said, it was easier to walk on. But secondly, he liked being a little bit shorter. Now, did you choose a certain height or were you at the mercy of the prosthesis that they gave you?
A little bit of both. So I'm lucky enough that I'm a left knee disarticulation. So I have my entire femur on my left leg. And so what that means is my left leg, when I have a prosthetic on there, tends to be a little bit longer than a normal leg might be because the bionic knee that you have is a certain – it can only get so short. Then the foot that you put on there can only get so short. There's a minimum distance that you have to have. And so for me, I actually end up being a little bit taller because of that that minimum distance of the prosthetic leg. But, you know, I've definitely heard about people, you know, getting shorter. You can select that optimal height for yourself. You know, when the taller you get, the harder it's going to be to balance usually. Up to a certain point. You know, when I have my running legs on, I'm probably 6'4", 6'5", because I wanted to try and maximize my stride length. So you can mess around with it, you can experiment, and you can find that optimal height.
Okay, well, talking about running then. So I know in your bio you talk about relearning cycling, running, and rowing. Which of those was first? And then, you know, what was that that experience like going from zero back to where you were prior to the explosion?
I think I think I learned to row first because there was a little bit of an issue with me relearning how to run, and that they made us do these bone density scans, and they wouldn't let you get running prosthetics unless you had a certain bone density. So it took me a few weeks in order to convince them to let me have the running legs. So I think I learned to row first, out on the water. And you know, took to that pretty naturally, and I really enjoyed it. I would go out there maybe two, three times a week. And then my rowing coach would actually come in. I convinced the physical therapist to let me bring my own rowing machine into the clinic, so that I could train on it. And they were more than happy to do that. And so he would come in a couple days a week, and we would do a workout on the erg machine. And then I learned to run, and then bike after that. And you know, I was able to run after my first, you know, on my first day, I was able to take some running steps. So it's kind of natural. I had been in prosthetics so long, the running technique kind of came naturally to me. But what took a long time was, again, just getting my body used to that motion and the pounding on my stumps that the running caused. And so I would run maybe 800 meters, you know, at a time, and that's done for the day in the beginning. And then I would go home and my legs would just be extremely sore. I mean, my right one would even swell up. So one time I got stuck in a parking lot because there was so swelled and something was pushing on something on my leg, and it was just so painful I couldn't walk, and I had to get carried into into my room and stuff. So, you know, that was a little bit frustrating to have to go through that, but like everything else, you know, I just kept at it, and eventually, you know, I can run as long as I wanted.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in a little while, because you didn't just run. I mean, you went above and beyond.
But I ran more than I wanted.
Yes, you did. All right, but stick on rowing for a moment. So again, doing just more than, you know, than rowing a little bit. So you actually set your eyes on the 2012 Paralympic Games. Yeah. I read in the bio you moved to Florida to do that, to train with your partner. So what was that journey, and whereabouts here in Florida did you train?
Yeah, so I realized that in order to compete at the top level in the world, you have to train every day. And so usually twice a day, every day. And so I knew that in December to March in Washington, D.C., that the likelihood of me being able to row every day was not very good. So we needed to go to a place where we could, you know, and so we moved ourselves to where we needed to be. And that was, we found some coaches down in Orlando, and we trained there for about 5 months.
Ah, okay. Cause that's where I work. I live in Ocala, and I work down in the fire department that protects Disney in Orlando.
Awesome. Yeah. We trained out of Lake Nona.
Oh, I know it well.
Yeah. Cool. So it's a great little lake, very scenic. It was perfect for rowing.
Absolutely. All right. So how was your, how did you guys fare in the 2012 Paralympics after that training?
We trained for 9 months, and we got a bronze.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So pretty happy with that, but not, we wanted to win, so we weren't totally satisfied, but nevertheless proud of what we were able to accomplish.
Absolutely. Now, I meant to ask this as well as a side note. Did you ever compete in the Invictus Games?
No, I haven't. And the reason for that is because, well, it's only been around, what, since 2014, maybe?
I think it is, yeah.
And so, obviously, I was training for rowing. And then I did my bike ride. So it's just worked out that I wasn't able to go to any of the qualifying events. But I do plan to do everything I can to make it this year.
Okay, yeah, because I think this might be the last year from what I understand. I think Prince Harry's...
I've heard that. I don't know. I've never read it myself, but I have heard it. So.
Yeah, what I was told was, I guess, because we've pulled a lot of the British forces out of the conflicts, they supposedly are not having the military casualties that they had before. That was the reason for them originally doing it, so they're getting the same athletes over and over again. I don't know if that's correct or not, but...
Well, I mean, so what?
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that bad?
No, exactly. Well, maybe I'll have a word. I'll talk to him.
Yeah, tell him.
All right. Well, you just mentioned the bike ride, so let's talk about this. So I have driven across America in a car, and that was exhausting. But you made a decision to go from Maine to California. So can you tell me first how that idea spawned and then how the hell you did it?
So it took me 9 months about to relearn how to ride a normal bicycle. And I decided to try and do that because I enjoyed riding bicycles. I was actually starting to get into mountain biking before I got hurt. So I wanted to maybe see if I could keep doing that. And so I relearned how to ride a bicycle. And on top of that, they said that nobody that had come through Walter Reed had ever relearned how to ride a bicycle as a double above the amputee. So that gave me a little bit of extra, you know, that it appealed to my frontier and pioneer personality, where I wanted to see if I could figure something else that nobody else had before. And, you know, it took a lot of time, and so I wanted to do something with it. But, you know, I'd already decided I was going to do the Paralympics, so I had to kind of put anything on the back burner. And then after I retired from rowing, I decided I would ride my bike across the country because I wanted to have an effect on the veteran population, in that because I kept seeing, you know, all these movies and stuff about, you know, all they were ever about was about how veterans come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I wanted to provide an alternative possibility and an alternative story. And so I set out to create my own and ride across the country.
Okay. So can you tell me the charities that you were supporting for that? Because I noticed there were several written down.
Yeah. So the three I supported on that one were Semper Fi Fund, the Coalition to Salute America's Heroes, and Ride to Recovery. And they're all just, you know, wounded veteran charities that have their own unique way of helping veterans recover, get back on their feet, and find their new way of contributing to their country.
Okay, and you said it took 9 months to get across the country. Is that what you said?
It took 9 months to relearn how to ride the bike, and then the whole ride took about 6 months, 5,180 miles.
Oh my goodness! Now, did you experience injuries along the way from such an amazing ride?
You know, I didn't. Soreness, to be sure, but no injuries. The closest I came to injury would have been in Missouri. I did this during the winter, so in Missouri, there was some black ice, and I fell and landed pretty hard. But luckily, you know, just a little bit of a sore back for the next couple of days, nothing, no injuries. So, you know, and all the cars I was riding around, I really lucked out.
Yeah, that's the people you got to watch out for.
Yeah.
All right, so you finished that. Was the marathon idea following that? Was there anything in between?
So after that, I tried to make the Paralympics again for triathlon. And so the triathlon was entering into the Paralympics in 2016. And so I figured I would try and do that. I figured that would be the sport that I was most set up for, just because of the bike ride. And sadly, I was not able to qualify, you know, a lot because I needed more time simply to break into their system of ranking and qualifying. It takes a really long time to do that. But mostly because I was racing on a regular bicycle. Most double above knee amputees would be racing with hand cycles and push wheelchairs. But I had decided, you know, I was stubborn and I wanted to ride my bike. And so I ended up racing against, you know, single above knee amputees and people that had all their limbs but had cerebral palsy, I think. And so, you know, they just had such an advantage over me on the bike that I was never able to get fast enough to catch up to them. They would just blow me out of the water, and I would reel him back in on the run, but I would never be able to catch all the way up.
Okay, well, the other portion we haven't discussed yet was swimming. So what kind of prosthesis do you use for the swimming portion?
They do not allow any prosthesis in the swimming portion for my category. And so what I would do, I would have – so the legs that I wore for the running and biking would have an inner socket that would fit to my leg using the silicone sleeve. And then in order to transition quickly, I would have the outer socket with the actual prosthetic attachment to it would be separate. And so I would attach that with a pin to the inner socket so I could switch between legs really quickly. So it would just be a matter of taking one off and putting one back on instead of going through all this other stuff that you usually have to do. So I would wear the inner socket. They would allow that. And then so I would swim in that, take my wetsuit off, and then put my running legs on, run into transition, switch to my bike legs, walk out of transition because I couldn't run in my bike legs, and then ride my bike, walk back into transition, switch legs, and then go out on the run. So my transitions actually really hurt me as well because I wasn't able to the single above knee amputees could kind of hop along pretty quickly, and I just had to, you know, walk on my bike legs.
Yeah, this is areas that you don't think of with you know, a non-amputee or non-Paralympic type race or Olympic event. Yeah. Is all these little you know, nuances that would give someone a huge advantage in areas like that.
And it was a pretty good system that I had, you know, for a double above knee amputee. It was a really good system, but you know, just my injury or my level of my disability just put me at that slight bit of disadvantage that I had to try and overcome, but I wasn't able to.
Okay, so with the swimming then, just want to get this clear in my head. So you had no prosthesis at all. So were you basically just swimming with your arms at that point?
Yeah, well, so swimming is actually mostly trunk. And you kind of grab the water with your arm and anchor off of it. And then you use your trunk to kind of power yourself past your arm. And so, yeah, I wasn't kicking. So I was just doing all arm and trunk.
Yeah, that sounds exhausting in itself. All right, so then going back to the marathons then. So your most recent venture, and this is where I came across you on social media, you did 31 marathons in 31 days. So firstly, is there a significance to the number 31? And then secondly, how the hell did you prepare for that?
The number was picked, so I wanted to do... I definitely wanted to do marathons because so many people identified with marathons, and everybody in the world knows that the marathon is kind of that bucket list item, and it's kind of the tough race that most people identify with. You know, obviously there's longer ones, but you know, everybody knows what a marathon is pretty much, and you know, everybody knows it's tough. So I wanted to do marathons, and I wanted to do something that would kind of make people's brains explode. And so I figured I would do just a ton of back-to-back marathons. And so when I was trying to pick the number, we have, everybody knows the number 22, or 20 is more accurate now, that is associated with, you know, veteran suicide. And so I thought about doing 22 in a row. But the problem I saw with that was I kind of figured that was too, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough marathons because I thought I would get going for the first 10 days and then it would be over by the time, you know, I kind of got some momentum. And so I want to do it longer. And then I thought, well, what if I just do 50? Cause that's a big, even number. And I've kind of figured that might be actually be a little bit too long because I thought I would get going and then people would kind of lose interest. It's like, well, is he, you know, that guy's still doing that. And so I kind of figured, well, I'll just go in between and I'll do a full month of marathons, and so the longest month is 31.
Okay, and where did you let me rephrase that, was there any pattern that you chose to do these marathons as far as geographically?
Not really. So I started in London because I wanted to bring in that, you know, kind of allied forces you know, they have the same issues over there as we do over here. And, you know, we didn't fight together, so we didn't fight alone overseas, so we shouldn't fight alone back here either. So I started in London, and then I knew I wanted to finish in Washington, D.C. on Veterans Day. So I just kind of set it up so that, you know, I had to fly from London. So I started on the East Coast, and then I just made sure that each city that I went to was, I would be able to make it, you know, after having run and then driven there. So most of the cities were about 6-7 hours apart. The longest one was 14 hours apart. And so that's pretty much how I patterned it. I went counterclockwise in order to hopefully get the northern states, northern cities in before it got too cold, and then the southern cities in after it got super hot. So,
right. And then the was the underlying thing again to raise awareness for veterans coming home?
Yeah, you know, it's just that continuation of that same thing. So my bike ride, I called Rob Jones Journey, and then this was Rob Jones Journey Month of Marathon. So it's just a continuation of what I started back then, and just adding to that story of a veteran that went overseas and, you know, found a new way to contribute to America, keep fighting for fellow veterans, and just kind of try and hopefully showing veterans that may be struggling, you know, that it is possible to have a traumatic experience and get past it and actually use it to become better.
Right. So that being said, what do you think is lacking in the process when our veterans come home, and what do you see as a solution for that?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I think what may happen is we kind of get allowed to see ourselves as victims and stagnate and maybe even become a little spoiled. So I'll use myself as an example. So if I could go back and change anything about my recovery, I would have gotten out of my wheelchair earlier and just thrown it in a trash can or something and just totally gotten rid of it. Because I definitely would have – I ended up having a reliance on that wheelchair. I was allowing myself to rely on it. And so I kind of got stuck in that groove of wanting to use the wheelchair everywhere I went. And it was kind of scary to commit to walking everywhere. And so I just, you know, fell back on the wheelchair, and nobody really pushed me to get rid of the wheelchair. You know, it was a very supportive environment, and they wanted everybody to kind of go at their own pace. But sometimes, you know, people do need a little bit of a push in some directions. And, you know, sometimes people would be allowed just to not even go to therapy and just, you know, say, screw it. And so, you know, and everybody in the area was catering to us. And so, you know, that kind of allowed me to feel, I think I got a little bit spoiled by that, and I kind of expected certain things, and, you know, I don't think that was great. And so I kind of had to correct for that after I left the military. And then you see, I just read that book Tribe by Sebastian Younger.
Yeah, I had him on when I started the podcast, and I had him on just the other day as well for a second time. Amazing.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, it was a really good book, and I liked a lot of the stuff that it said in it. But it had this one section about the wounded veterans, and it talked about how the government should cure wounded veterans, how society can cure wounded veterans. But it didn't say anything about how the wounded veteran can cure themselves. So it took the personal responsibility of the veteran out of the equation. And so I kind of think there's a little bit of a pervading atmosphere of that, that the, you know, the veteran isn't responsible for their own recovery, and that it should be the government, or it should be the military, it should be the VA that gives them a magic pill or gives them a magic method that automatically cures them or gives them enough money to find this magic thing that cures them, when really it's them taking personal responsibility for it. And so I definitely think that it's important that all these organizations and you know society wants to help wounded veterans. That is definitely that's should be a requirement. But we just have to remember that, you know, we are all warriors and we are responsible for that personally. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And you walk the walk, exactly. And I think that's what we're seeing with, because PTSD in first responders has been suppressed incredibly. You know, the whole being able to even accept it. It's like the military can accept it and that's fine. But, you know, we're different. It's still being soft if you admit that you are struggling. And it's now finally starting to gain some traction. But now what you're seeing is on the fringes, you've still got the ridiculous notion that it doesn't exist. But then on the other side, you've almost got, you can see this just kind of rumblings of, well, you know, we'll get this to go through and then we can retire and never do anything again. And that's completely wrong as well. And just like you've proven physically with your physical injuries, and really, let's be honest, with your mental injuries as well, you've come out a lot stronger from that too. Is the middle ground is you get hurt, absolutely you're going to need some time and medical treatment, whatever it is, to heal your mental injury, to heal your physical injury. But the goal at the end of it is to come back stronger. And you absolutely walk the walk. And I think that other fringe is what we're talking about. There's that, you know, that small amount of people that see it as an opportunity just to not address it instead of coming back stronger and learning from it.
Yeah, you know, I'm certainly not saying that if you need help, you shouldn't, you know, try and get help. You definitely should. You need to do whatever you need to do in order to heal, is my point. And so if that involves so for me, it was pretty clear cut. I needed to go into therapy and get prosthetic legs and get myself stronger and practice with the prosthetic legs and do all that stuff. If I didn't do all that stuff, I would never have learned how to use the, I would just be sitting around in a wheelchair or in a bed all day. I still had to go out and do all that stuff, and just wanting to be able to walk on my legs wasn't going to get me there. I had to go out and do the work. And so it's a little bit different with these psychological injuries, because it's not exactly clear what you're supposed to do to recover from that. Nobody really knows for sure. And so it's a lot harder to figure that out and actually do it. But you can't just sit around and wait for the government to figure it out. You can't sit around and wait for the VA to figure it out. You have to go out and just try everything you can, and do research yourself and just try everything, in order to make that happen. So you are ultimately responsible. You know, if I went into the clinic and I said, I don't really feel like walking today, I'm just going to go home, the therapist would probably say, well, okay, you know, all right. And no, it would have no effect on they would go home to their families at night and be, you know, they would have their normal life. You know, it didn't affect them. Whereas I'm the one that has to live with that every single day for the rest of my life. So I needed to take the personal responsibility.
Yeah. And that's what we're seeing, sadly, in our civilian population as well. You know, they're going into these doctor's offices demanding statins and, you know, painkillers instead of taking the time and investing in themselves, in reversing, you know, whatever disease process they've started through exercise, through nutrition, and taking ownership of their own health.
Yeah, there's that sentiment is definitely universal. There seems to be a sentiment now that people are expecting, you know, they say, we have so many homeless people in this country, somebody should do something about that. You know, it's like, well, we all recognize that there's a problem, but nobody's actually willing to take that problem, you know, take the responsibility for solving it. Well, somebody should do it. You know, not me, but somebody.
Yeah. No, exactly. And also, I think the other issue was that that that's tarring an entire spectrum of people with the same brush, everyone from the people that are jumping in the Mercedes at the end of the day and going back to their mansion, which we hear these horror stories, all the way through to the, you know, veterans or whoever with mental health issues that truly need, you know, the help to get off the streets and back on their feet again.
Yeah. And I just want to get it out there that it's not the only possibility isn't the veteran that comes home with severe psychological injuries. I want to get that whole, I'm not saying that we should ignore that or that isn't something that happens. It certainly is. And we need to address that and we need to do everything we can for those people. But it is not the only possibility. And so I just want both sides of those, you know, both sides of that coin to be out there so that people can just have a better understanding of, you know, what it's like to be a wounded veteran.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I tell you right now, from, again, the outside looking in, I'm a fireman. I'm not a soldier, and I'm, you know, a viewer on social media. But that is definitely the message that I'm getting from you and your other, you know, fellow veterans that are out there inspiring people and not using whatever injury, mental or physical, as an excuse. Now, obviously, it's a horrendous injury. We're not taking that away. But to me, that gives us, you know, even more respect that someone is not only doing extremely well physically or inspiring people with a body that's uninjured, but to go through that, heal from the trauma, and then come back and instead of create almost a victim mentality, but use that as an inspiration to stop other people from going through similar things or inspire other injured people to be an athlete, to get out there and have a full life. I mean, it's incredible, and my hat's off to you.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I hope to get out there. But, you know, I also have to say at the same time, I've never struggled with post-traumatic stress. So I don't have firsthand knowledge of it. And you know, this is just kind of my theory. And so having never struggled with it, it's easy for me to say a lot of this stuff. And so, you know, I realize that there's a lot more to it than just deciding to do something. So,
yeah. Well, I think though, to counter that just for a moment, Tim Kennedy, about a year ago now, put out a little, it was just a post on Facebook, but it was amazing with the fact that he's aware of the, you know, the trauma, but the way he got over it was getting up every day and fulfilling his life and doing good in the world, you know, trying to be that sheepdog. And that's what kept him with that strong mentality. And I think that that's maybe the underlying reason why you haven't had the PTSD, you know, the actual disorder side, is you've taken that stress and you've turned it around and not only overcome it physically and using exercise, but also given yourself a mission to give back, which is probably the complete polar opposite of the disorder side of PTSD.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe, you know, I've never experienced it, but hopefully this will be, it's kind of like, you know, this is an idea for you to try maybe. So that's a good point.
Okay, well then, I guess the last question before we do some short wrap up questions would be: do you have another physical feat that you are planning?
Not right now. I don't have it because, you know, the month of marathons was like kind of a perfect storm of you know, running in all these different cities that were, you know, get so many eyeballs on it, and then the marathon is something that everybody identifies with. And it was, you know, I think it was just about the right length of time spent. And, you know, it was something that I, you know, people did not expect me to be very fast because I'm a double above knee amputee. So people would not expect that I'd be able to actually run very fast at all. And I kind of, you know, dispelled that myth. And so it was kind of a perfect storm and all that, in that regard. And so I have to really take my time. I don't want to do something just to do it, just to say that I did something. I want to do something, you know, that interests me and can really have that maximum effect. And so I really need to take a lot of time in order to figure out what that might be. And so right now I'm toying with the idea of maybe doing some like 100-mile ruck marches or something. So nothing that would take a month or anything, but maybe something that might take a few days, and then I could do that maybe several times throughout the year. I don't know, but nothing that I'm committing to at the moment.
Okay, and you
once I commit to it, that means I'm doing it, and so
you don't want to commit.
Once I say I'm committing, so I will not commit to it until I'm absolutely sure.
All right. Well, one other thing as well. So you learn how to walk, how to run, how to row, how to cycle, how to swim. Is there anything that you either did before the injury or you've never done in your life that you, aside from any challenge or fundraiser, just something that you have wanted to try or get back to that you haven't yet since you got hurt?
Nothing that I'm really missing a whole lot. And I need to try. I used to play racquetball in college. And I really enjoyed that. And I'm sure I could again. I just haven't, you know, taken the time to go in and try and do that. I wouldn't mind doing some snowboarding or skiing. I'd never done that before, really. I've done it once before when I was able-bodied. So I wouldn't mind just trying that and seeing what that's like. Mountain biking, I would like to try. So the problem for me in mountain biking is I can't get on a bike going uphill at a certain steepness. So it would be very tricky and risky for me to try and go mountain biking, because if I, you know, didn't make it up a hill, then I'm kind of screwed. So I'll just leave it at those three. So there's a few things, but you know, nothing that I'm really dying to get back to.
Right. Yeah. Snowboarding sounds like an awesome one, because I mean, you can wipe out on a board and still be pretty good. So.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I getting in the gym was probably would if I hadn't have been able to do that, then that would be eating at me. But you know, I was able to, you know, figure out ways to that I could still be able to lift weights. Like I was, I can't do everything. I can't do squats or anything like that. But I figured out how to do deadlifts when I was in the clinic. I had my physical therapist put a belt around my waist and kind of hold my lower half up. And then so that my upper half, so basically I would do a straight leg deadlift, and I kind of evolved that into I'll just tie myself off to a squat rack or a pole, and then I'll do deadlifts. And when I was rowing, I could do 300 pounds. So, you know, I was able to get a pretty decent lift.
Yeah, that is a decent lift. Yeah, I think I was telling BJ Miller, the doctor I mentioned before, it seems like this sounds like a weird thing to say, a great time to be an amputee, but that adaptive world, especially in the CrossFit world, you're seeing so many like certification programs now, and so many creative ways of working around some sort of amputation or injury, where there's these athletes, some like quadruple I'm assuming from birth amputees or you know, no limbs on the upper or lower body, and they're still able to do cleans and these amazing movements. So
it's just a matter of taking the time to figure it out, man. You just have to want to try and do it, and then you just experiment, see what works, see what doesn't work. And there's actually a gym down in Texas that is entirely dedicated to disabled athletes. Just training, all they do is train disabled athletes. Which is actually an idea I had when I was in the hospital, and I'm glad that somebody was able to do it. I wish I could remember the name. But yeah, it's down in Texas, and they're doing that. All they do is train disabled athletes.
That's phenomenal. Have you visited it yourself?
No, I want to, and I've been emailing them, and we're in talk, so I will go down there. It's called Adaptive Training Foundation. So yes, a former football player, and yeah, he just got together with somebody, and it's awesome. So I do plan on going down there at some point.
Fantastic. All right. Well, you've been very, very generous with your time. I got a couple of wrap up questions, and then, sure. You know, let you get on with your day. First one I always ask people, is there a book that you recommend to people? It can be about anything.
Man, there'd be so many books. My favorite book from a fiction perspective is Gates of Fire. That'd probably be the one that I would recommend. Let me think, nonfiction. I do like Jocko's book for nonfiction in terms of the mental mindset.
Extreme Ownership.
Yeah. Well, all three of them, I guess, you know, would probably be good, but, I think those probably be my two, just for that mental aspect.
Okay, and I know you were on his show. I haven't had a chance to listen to that yet. It's on my queue to listen to on the podcast because I love his stuff too.
Oh yeah, it was a lot of fun. That was a really cool experience, and as is this.
Good. All right, the next question, is there a guest that you would recommend come on this podcast to talk to the police, fire, EMS of the world?
Let me think. I'm gonna have to think about that one, man.
I guess a lot of people stumped. I should probably email them ahead of time.
Well, there's just so many people. I guess it just, what do you think, what kind of a guest would you need? Because I have a lot of people. Like, if you need somebody, you know, to talk about like training for fires or to talk about, you know, stuff like I'm talking about.
I would say just someone unique who's inspired you that made you realize something you'd never thought about before. That's kind of the angle I like.
I would recommend Bobby Henline because he is a guy, and it might, you know, dealing with fires, he was burned over 30% of his, or he was third degree burns over a large proportion of his body in Iraq. And, you know, now he does stand up comedy. And so, you know, I would recommend him. And so you might have some firefighters that have some severe burns. I don't know.
Yeah, we do. Actually, my very first guest, Mitch Dreyer, was severely burned. He actually was an amputee as well. He lost one of his arms in the burn.
So. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right.
And yeah, then, I could put you guys in touch if you want.
Please do. I'd love that. And then the last one before we talk about where we can find you online is what do you do to decompress when you are not either cycling across the country or doing multiple marathons?
You know, I like to read a book read books, listen to podcasts. I'm getting into hunting, so I'll take that up as a hobby. I like, you know, that's, you know, it's fun, you know, you get some meat and then, you know, you get to hang out with your friends for the day. And, there's a lot of camaraderie that comes along with that. So yeah, just that kind of stuff.
Brilliant. And then, well, then the very last thing then, so where can people listening find you, and are there any, sites that you were looking for funding for as far as charities?
My website is robjonesjourney.com. And any kind of, if they do want to donate to what I've done, you can still do that on my website. You just go to the main page and it'll be there. And there'll be all sorts of information about the charities that I raise money for. We didn't mention the third one. I actually changed my third one. So this, my marathon challenge was Semper Fi Fund Coalition of Salute America's Heroes and the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, which you probably might have heard of.
Absolutely, yes.
So I raised money for them on this month of marathons. And have you thought about doing their tower climb in New York?
I have, yeah. There's multiple things that I want to do, and that's one of them, the Tunnel to Towers and the climb.
Okay. So, yeah, well, I'm going to be doing that this year, so you should come up and join. I always make a team. And so you should come up and be on my team this year.
Okay,
if you can make it.
In September?
The run is September. I think the tower climb is usually June.
Okay, let's make that work. I will say publicly now, let's do it.
Yeah, I'm going to hold you to it.
There we go. Now you got me stuck.
if you pull out, I'm going to publicly shame you on Twitter.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I know I just reached out randomly online and you immediately said yes. So I'm so glad we're able to have this conversation. I know it's going to be, A, inspiring to, you know, the first responders out there, but B, you know, again, make people think about injuries and challenges, and are they really, you know, going to alter your life, or are you just going to be able to overcome them just like you've shown us you can? So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you having me on, and hope people just are able to use this and figure out exactly what you just said.